Good afternoon and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Lauren Landis. The late Patty Fink is again very, very late because she's still running late from last week when she wasn't here. So maybe she'll be here next week. Our guests today are Chris Soden and Logan Cure. They're poets and they have an event coming up for Pride Week. Today is the Pride Parade. The parade starts at 2, right after the show, so you can listen to the show as you're driving down to Cedar Springs.
Will there be a naked man in the parade? No.
But what there will be is about 125 entries in this year's parade. It's the largest parade we've ever had. It starts at Wycliffe, goes down Cedar Springs, all the way to Turtle Creek, turns toward Reverchon Park, and then the festival in the park lasts until 7 p.m. tonight. Grand Marshals, one of them has been a guest of ours from SOS.
Survivors, and
I'm blank because I'm just talking and not listening to what I'm even saying.
What, are you trying to figure out his name?
Yeah.
Oh.
Dr. God, I forgot. Thank you. Thank you. That's what we're. I could hear any of us.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. We need to.
Okay. So anyway, Pride Parade is this afternoon, and lots of security there. Police have said no security threats that they know of, but they've been working really diligently to make sure that this is a very safe parade. Yesterday was Teen Pride at Oakland United Methodist Church. It was a wonderful event. I was there for about an hour. Had a lot of fun with the kids that were there. And it's good to see so many young people who are out and proud and doing lots of stuff. Our guests today, like I said, Chris Soden, Logan Cure, they are poets. And because this is such a poetical show, isn't it? You can listen to the way I'm speaking today incoherently. Logan, tell us a little bit about the event.
So our event is Pandora's Box. So Pandora's Box is a poetry series that's been operating in Dallas for about 3 years. Our home right now is the Contemporary Theater of Dallas. On Wednesday at 8 o'clock, we're going to be having an LGBT Pride reading, including myself and Christopher, as well as a lineup of other amazing poets, including Bear Roadhaver, Jolie Davis, Valerie Crow, Nadia Wolnitsky, Lauren Belmore, Michael Rains, Gail Bell, and some others that are going to be fantastic.
Okay, now, of course, I know who these people are, but Lauren is a little bit illiterate. Could you tell us a little bit about who some of these poets are?
Sure. Yeah, Nadia Wolnitsky, she is a marvelous poet. She's more of a performance poet, and I just recently got to hear some of her amazing poetry. It's very quirky. She's very laid back. She's very, she's very zen, but she just sort of acquires this intriguing energy when she gets up on the stage. James Bear Rodenhaver, everybody calls him Bear. He's just a little guy, kind of a little skinny guy, but everyone calls him Bear. And when I first met him, I thought, everyone calls this guy Bear? But he's just, when he gets up on that stage, he just turns into a tiger. Tiger or bear, you decide. Mm-hmm. But he's a very fierce performer. And really overwhelming. He's just marvelous. He'll break your heart. Michael Rains used to teach at the Walt Whitman School.
Awesome.
His stuff is more literary, I'd say, but very rich. He's been influenced a lot by the poetry of Tennessee Williams.
And I just want to stop a minute. You were on the show already then, because you're very old, Lauren. Mm-hmm. But the Walt Whitman School was the school that we had for about 3 years here in Dallas that was an LGBT school.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he taught English there.
So a lot of people, but a lot of our listeners wouldn't even remember it by this point, which is sad. But
yeah.
Because it closed in about 2000, maybe 2001.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Sadly.
Yeah.
Sadly, I wish we could. We should revive it.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Oh, it really would.
Yeah.
I'd teach there in a heartbeat. Yeah, Michael's a very cute ginger. He's got a great sense of humor. His poetry's very, yeah, it's got lots of density. He was influenced a lot by the poetry of Tennessee Williams, as a matter of fact. You know, I never understood why you would call a redhead ginger. Shouldn't it be like more like paprika, maybe?
Good you question. Know?
Because ginger really... Okay, so anyway. Logan's going to be reading. Logan is a dear friend, and her poetry just sends me into orbit.
And we're going to hear a little bit of it in just a little bit. Logan is looking through her phone, finding something. Do you have something, Logan?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Why don't we just go right to that?
Oh, of course. Well, you know,
jump right. Let's just jump into a little bit of poetry, then Laurent asks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a poem that is from the full-length manuscript that I'm working on right now. This is called Camera Shy. Your junior prom date is in only one photo. Fellow misfit cleaned up nice, he stands stiffly next to you in your parents' foyer. He doesn't even have his arm around you. He'd skipped his meds, snapped before you can even order dinner, starts pacing and cursing, and you, despite your braces, your borrowed dress, the truly unfortunate miscommunication that resulted in your present haircut, you are going to have fun, with or without him. Your year had been glorious, rich with pretty friends. They'd done everything to convince you, found you the dress, introduced you to him, and tonight they did not disappoint. The photos catch them laughing, luminous, linked arm in arm with you, showing off sparkly shoes and complicated updos. Your posture tells everyone you've never worn a strapless dress before. They say you look beautiful, and you just believe them. Ducking your date as the slow dance comes on, you're surprised to feel someone clasp your hand. Dance with me. And then in your arms, the Filipina girl in all your classes, whose name you savored syllable by sweet syllable every time she corrected the tortuous tongues of substitute teachers. She sways close to you. The baby's breath in her hair brushes your cheek. You almost don't hear the clowny boy in the lime green vest gasp dramatically as he gawks at you. He gapes, points. She laughs, tosses him her camera and says, "Don't just stare, take a picture." As a flash goes off, you feel yourself stand up straight.
Okay, how much of that came from your actual life?
I was about to say, how biographical is that?
Very, actually. Yeah, that was definitely a scene taken from my real junior prom. And that photo really exists.
Awesome.
Okay, now, before the show, you were telling us a little bit about it, and you just briefly said, this is from my full-length manuscript that I'm working on. Tell us about what the manuscript's about, because I think that's just fascinating.
Thank you. The manuscript is a queer coming of age set in my West Texas hometown. I'm from Midland, Texas, which is the hometown of Friday Night Lights and George W. Bush, if you're not familiar.
Friday Night Lights, I am wearing the t-shirt right now.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Just to let you know, David has...
I consider myself a graduate of Dillon
history.
High School.
He has history with that. He was an extra on the show.
I was more than an extra.
Okay, I think... Did you actually have a line?
I did have a couple of
Very
lines.
Very nice.
A couple of
it was,
you want to hear my line? I can do my line.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Coach!
They filmed the movie Friday Night Lights when I was senior in high school, and I was not in the band, but I was friends with like everybody in the band. My wife was in the band, and they used the real Lehigh Band to be the Lehigh Band
cool.
in the film. So while they were filming, I had like no friends because everybody was gone filming.
The line I did was from season 2. Let me do my line from season 3. Coach!
Wow.
And from season 4. Coach!
I totally believe that.
Do you believe it?
Yeah. That was so,
I like the variation you brought to it. That's really
very convincing.
That's because I'm an actor.
Yeah. Yeah. Extra layer of depth every time.
Right. You know, and it's interesting when you said Midland. One thing Friday Night Lights did was give a small West Texas town all of this rich texture and culture that we don't think of living in Dallas as these small towns, as small towns have. We don't think that they have that. But that's what you're looking for. Give us some examples of some of the oddities that you've been finding in your town.
So much of the manuscript is a queer coming of age. So it's things like going to prom, learning to drive a standard car, you know, just sort of your regular coming of age things all through this queer lens. And I've also tried to apply a queer lens to a lot of other things. So I write a lot about the desert itself, creatures like the coyote. There is a terrifying wasp, the tarantula hawk wasp, that in order to reproduce, it preys on tarantulas. So it lays an egg, and when the new wasp is born, it feeds on a paralyzed tarantula first.
Laurent does that.
That is like its first.
Do you buy it a drink first?
You know what? They really should. so it's that. It's these creatures that have these sort of extreme strategies for surviving in a harsh environment. And then there's other things that sort of historical things that are interesting. Baby Jessica, who fell in a well, is my age and from Midland. So I have a poem about that. Of course, there's also the desert, so I have a poem about some folks in 1891 who were given government money to shoot heavy artillery into the sky to see if they could make it rain. They had evidence, quote-unquote, from lots of different military officers who talked about rain following major conflicts. So they thought that there was like some sort of scientific connection between things exploding and rain.
And that's not so far off, because we do have cloud seeding.
Yes, that is still something that people are sort of experimenting with mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. So researching into my hometown has been...
And do you know who actually invented cloud seeding? And it was at my school. Bernard Vonnegut is the one who came up with it. He's Kurt Vonnegut's brother.
Nice. Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Wow.
So some of the things that you're talking about as far as, you know, relative to Midland. Did you just know these things? Is this just kind of things that everybody in Midland knows? Did you kind of have to actually investigate?
I had to really look into it. Midland is sort of an interesting mix of gossip and burying secrets. And that was sort of my experience of it growing up there, right? A mixture of gossip.
Right.
And trying very hard to bury some secrets. it's more of sort of more for survival than anything. So there have been so many things that I sort of knew from growing up there that had so much more depth when I started to look into them. Some things that, you know, that seem very public, and when you start to dig into them, turn out there are a lot of secrets underneath there. So I'm sort of interested in stories, the way people tell themselves their stories, the way the community tells stories.
Yeah. Now, because like the Baby Jessica story, I mean, that wasn't just local. That was that whole thing had the entire nation on the edge of their seats for hours at a time.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and I guess, what was it, like 88, 87, something like that?
Yeah, so it was one of the first, like, real media frenzies. The mm-hmm. first real media frenzy would have been the Challenger explosion.
Yes.
Yes.
I remember that.
So Baby Jessica would have been one of the next major things that happened that had that, like, 24-hour coverage. So now we're all really used to that. We're mm-hmm. used to things being covered right now, having sort of constant access to frenzy, right? But at that time, this was new. So people were glued to their televisions the whole time she was down in that well. And they saved her life, but if they hadn't, that would have also been just incredibly public.
For those who have no idea what we're talking about, in 87, 88, this baby fell down a well in the backyard. Was it her grandparents' home?
It was her aunt's home, I want to say, but her mother was there.
Okay.
So she fell 22 feet down an 18-inch in diameter pipe.
Very deep.
Yes, very
deep. Very narrow.
Yes, and was down there for a couple of days, over 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to drill like a parallel tunnel mm-hmm. to get her mm-hmm. out of there. But it was this major thing. And Midland is, there's a public building in Midland where you can walk in, and there is a mural that's like massive. It takes up a huge, huge wall, and it's this image of all the people like pulling her out, and they've got, she's like this perfect, pristine looking, like glowing baby, like on a pillow, like foisted above everybody's head, and that's such, like, just so super inaccurate to what was actually happening.
It really was. I remember what she looked like when they pulled her out.
Yes, there was a photograph that was taken that like won a Pulitzer, right?
Yeah.
That, where she is like just tremendously, tremendously injured. I mean, she had injuries that affected her for the rest of her life.
Yeah. Well, she fell.
Well, not only that, stories. But she's like, you have to be a contortionist to able to survive it. But again, babies are.
But one of the things they said at the time was, it's a good thing this happened in Midland and not somewhere up north, because in Midland they had the drilling equipment there. They just went down the street, got the drilling equipment, and started.
So Midland sort of tells themselves that story about like, oh, well, you know, with our like skill for drilling and our down-home determination, and part of that story is trying to sort of frame Midland in this heroic way, which I think is the result, that mural where it's sort of glorified as a result of that, which is like, that's very strange to me that Midland wants to tell themselves that story in that way, especially juxtaposed with that Pulitzer-winning photo that I think really encapsulates like the devastation for that child. Right.
So there wasn't an angel chorus singing when they pulled her from the well.
Unless you want to call the media and all the lights angels.
No.
Right. Yeah.
We need to take a break. We're talking to Christopher Soden and Logan Cure. They're poets, and they have an event coming up. It's the Gertrude Stein and Allen Ginsberg LGBT Pride Reading, presented by Pandora's Box, which is Christopher's organization that
I'm one of the founding members. And
it's going to be at the Contemporary Theater of Dallas, which is at 5601 Sears Street. That's right near Ross. It's off Rossap Avenue.
Yeah, it's like two blocks from Greenville.
From where Ross and Greenville come together.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, it's a great venue. I've got to give Contemporary Theater of Dallas credit. I have a friend there named Mickey Bone, and she offered to let us use their theater as a venue. They do marvelous, marvelous work. There's plenty of parking. There's a full bar. It's a wonderful place for a poetry
And it is
reading.
This Wednesday at 8 p.m. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with LaRon Landis, and we'll be back with more right after this.
I'm Jelinski Brown with Resource Center United Black Element, and I listen to Lambda Weekly radio program on 89.3 K9, the voice of the people. I am the people, so hear me speak.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here with LaRon Landis. Our guests are Chris Soden, whose book of poetry is called Closer. Logan Cure has two books still, and Letters to Petrarch, and is the editor of Voicemail Poems. They both have an event coming up. We'll give you all the details on that again a little bit later. LaRon, you said.
We're here to talk about the Pride reading, the Gertrude Stein and Allen Ginsberg LGBT Pride reading. This is the first of any such reading I've ever heard of. You said this is the third installment?
Well, it's probably the second.
The second?
Yeah, but Pandora's Box has done two Pride readings.
You can just move that mic around to where you actually
say,
are.
Is this mic on?
Yeah.
It's a high-tech mic, yes.
There we go.
This is the second one we've done. Pandora's Box, we do different events every month, and this is our second Pride reading. You know, I felt like after the Orlando incident, you know, I mean, it's always a good idea to do a Pride reading, but especially with it having happened so recently, it felt good. It felt right.
Can you talk a little bit about what prompted the creation of this from get-go?
The Pride reading?
Mm-hmm.
We're always trying to come up with something for each month that is intriguing and appropriate and is going to be compelling. And I'm very, very fortunate to know some just amazing queer poets who just know how to, you know, blow the roof off the joint. And I thought, you know, this is a good opportunity for us because September's coming up. We don't really have anything, planned for that month yet. And so I really made a case for it. Paul Konecki and I are the co-founders of Pandora's Box, and then we had three other board members. But, you know, I just felt like, You know, it's because the voices of the queer poetry community are so disparate, and each one is so intriguing and beautiful. And, you know, I'm really thrilled with our lineup because they're really varied. And, you know, some are more quiet, some are more ferocious, but it's all beautiful and rich.
Are they all here? I know you told us a little bit about some of the individuals. Are they all from Texas or spread out?
Oh, that's...
Or live in Dallas now.
Oh, yeah, they definitely live
in
Dallas.
They're all living here. These are people you brought in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, we don't have the deep pockets to fly in some of that. I wish we did.
Right.
But no, I know all these people and, you know, have heard their work. And so, yeah, they're all local. Absolutely.
Awesome.
Okay, now, this is... And we're going to get to your poetry, too, in, probably before the end of this segment. But... It's the Gertrude Stein and Allen Ginsberg poetry reading. Tell us a little bit about each of them and why you named it that.
Well, I felt like, you know, I wanted to do honor and homage to a couple of the poets, you know, the queer poetry voices that had such a huge impact on the world. I remember reading in the newspaper that Allen Ginsberg has the most recognizable name in the world of poetry. And when he wrote Howl and had that huge obscenity trial just to defend it, and it's such an amazing poem anyway. It's very graphic, but it's very exquisite, and it's just so alive, and it's just so gorgeous. And
do you know which one of his works is actually my favorite? Is Kaddish.
Oh, yes.
Which
for
is,
mom,
Kaddish is the Jewish prayer for the dead. And it's a poem to his mother and about his mother and his relationship, his complicated relationship.
Oh, it's lovely. Yeah.
And if you haven't seen, or if you don't want to read it, I encourage you, all listeners, go check out the movie Hal. Really, really good.
Yes.
Very, very good.
It's just splendid.
Right. The trial is just amazing.
Oh, yeah, and it brought it all kinds of, you know, it brought Ginsberg and the poem all kinds of attention. I wish someone would, you know, bring me to an obscenity trial.
You know, isn't it interesting, though, and just the concept of an obscenity trial?
Yeah.
What is an obscenity trial?
But, you know, what's interesting about it is not only just the work, because obviously it's brilliant, but... It's an interesting combination of poetry, law, the First Amendment, right? All
mm-hmm.
of that.
Yeah.
It's a really, it's really interesting.
They were suing City Lights mm-hmm. bookstore in San Francisco, and there was this attorney who just thought it was vile and just subversive and like those are bad things. And... He was just determined to just go after Ginsberg and the man who...
Because Ginsberg was gay.
Yeah, and he, right. and he's
That's
very frank
really
about yeah. you know, what it, about his homo... it has very frank homoerotic passages, but they're very poetic. Mm-hmm. They're very lyrical, so what difference does it make?
Well, and that's another great event we did for Pandora's Box. We did a band poetry reading last mm-hmm. year, and there was a... Christopher was part of a group performance of Howl. It's sort of an installment throughout the show. They performed the entirety of Howl, which is super long.
It's very long. A lot of Ginsberg's works are.
Yeah. So it was several yes. people, and, you know, we sort of opened, and I think there was, like, a middle portion of it, and then we closed on it. And then there
were all guys who read it, which was fun.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was great. And then we read a lot of other poems that had been banned at different times. It was, like, ranging from everything from, like, Gwendolyn Brooks to Shel Silverstein. And we talked about why those different things were banned. And it was really interesting because some of the things that were read were, like, things that are banned right now and people who have been, like, incarcerated and persecuted for their work, mm-hmm. like, right now. So I thought that was
LaRon
really
and I
powerful.
Are banned from other stations. KNON, I promise you, is the only place who would have us.
Definitely a step in the right direction,
I guess. Do you have one of Ginsberg's poems with you that out?
It just so happens.
Okay.
Yes, I had to pick a shorter one for obvious reasons, because as David was saying, Kaddish and Howl just go for pages and pages. And
Kaddish is about 60 pages long or so, something like that.
Yeah, and I mean well-deserved, but this one is also a famous poem by Ginsberg, and it talks about Whitman, who was a huge influence on Ginsberg.
It's also called, a gay poet.
Oh, definitely. Although he never owned that before he passed over, but yeah, I think it's pretty safe bet.
Well, since he wrote some poetry to his lovers.
Yeah, oh, listen, I'm not debating.
Well, okay,
I'm sure he was.
So, right.
I'm one of his love children. Yeah. Oh, well, that doesn't really... Sorry. Whoops. Okay, so this is called A Supermarket in California, and it's one of Ginsberg's better-known poems, one of his famous poems. What thoughts I have of you tonight, Walt Whitman, for I walk down the streets under the trees with a headache, self-conscious, looking at the full moon. In my hungry fatigue and shopping for images, I went into the neon fruit supermarket, dreaming of your enumerations. What peaches and what penumbras, whole families shopping at night, aisles full of husbands, wives in the avocados, babies in the tomatoes, and you, Garcia Lorca, what were you doing down by the watermelons? I saw you, Walt Whitman, childless, lonely old grubber, poking among the meat in the refrigerator and eyeing the grocery boys. I heard you asking questions of each. Who killed the pork chops? What priced bananas? Are you my angel? I wandered in and out of the brilliant stacks of cans following you and followed in my imagination by the store detective. We strode down the open corridors together, in our solitary fancy, tasting artichokes, possessing every frozen delicacy, and never passing the cashier. Where are we going, Walt Whitman? The doors close in an hour. Which way does your beard point tonight? I touch your book and dream of our odyssey in the supermarket and feel absurd. Will we walk all night through solitary streets? The trees add shade to shade, lights out in our houses. We'll both be lonely. Will we stroll dreaming of the lost America, of lost past blue automobiles and driveways, home to our silent cottage? Ah, dear Father Graybeard, lonely old courage teacher, what America did you have when Sharon quit poling his ferry and you got out on a smoking bank and stood watching the boat disappear on the black waters of Leith?
Very nice. You both have, you know, it seems like you're just natural at it, not just writing, but reading it. What, can you tell us about when you all started your own poetry writing?
I have been writing, like, literally since I could write. so that's, you know, all my life, pretty much. I self-published a book when I was a sophomore in college. I was 19. And that was when I started to perform. So I went to Texas A&M, and College Station had more of a performance poetry community. So I realized that I needed to read in front of people if I wanted to move copies of the book. Mm. And I was terrified. I had a massive fear of public speaking. And I just sort of had to get over it. Mm-hmm. I was going to put all of that effort and time into making a book. I couldn't just let it sit there. So I learned, figured it out. And I think that was really powerful for me sort of starting out in that performance community. Because it is focused a lot on voice and gesture and movement in a way that I was just sort of thrown in the deep end. And I had to figure it out and get good at it mm-hmm. so that I could compete with everybody, like literally, right, in slams and that kind of thing, but also to get people interested in my work. Mm-hmm. And it was really powerful, too, in that, you know, when you're writing is a very lonely endeavor. And a lot of your audience is imagined, right? You sort of... publish these things or put these things out in the world, and you may not know really what the reaction is, but when you are reading in front of an audience, that reaction is immediate. You can make a connection that is palpable.
And they really are two different talents. I was part of the debate and speech team throughout high school and junior high doing poetry and prose. And you're right, writing it and then performing it are two different things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you find one more gratifying or therapeutic than the other?
Definitely. You know, I studied theater first. I studied it in high school and in college before I changed. Well, when I was in college, I met my poetry mentor, and that was when I changed my major to poetry. But yeah, I love the theater, and so it is. It's very different. I mean, you just have to just get up in front of people, and you just have to say, okay, here I am. You have to be unapologetic, and you just have to put yourself out there and tap into your natural narcissism, which might come easier to me than most people.
But first you have to be a writer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Otherwise you don't have those things to... I mean, you could perform somebody else's poetry.
You could, mm-hmm. and people do, but mm-hmm. it may not be the same interpretation, same, you know, feeling that it, that some, the writer would have.
And it's a tremendous opportunity to invite people into your work, mm-hmm. because I definitely identify with what Logan said about it being a solitary pursuit. So when you're up there in front of people and you can say, this is what I want you to know about me. Mm-hmm. You know, so it feels so great to be able to do that, because, you know, then you have that sense of reaching out to the world instead of when you send something out and you don't know what's going to happen to you.
And, you know, it's interesting when you say that it's a very lonely thing to do, and you're really reaching into yourself. The type of writing I do as a reporter is I'm reporting on other things, but the stories that I really like to tell, you know, I'll have some weeks in the paper, you know, I reported on an event, I reported on, blah, you know, it's just I called somebody, got the information, blah, 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 and told it. The stories I like are the ones about discrimination and how somebody fought back against it, that type of thing, where there's a real good story in there. One of the ones, and they were on our show a number of years ago, a couple, their parents sent them to reparative therapy. They both arrived at the same time. They looked at each other. They fell in love.
And got married.
How great. They met in reparative therapy.
Yeah. So, it, you know... But the best thing for me, when you know, you're saying it's a lonely thing to do, and then getting people, you know, you're performing it and getting people to really embrace the story. My favorite thing is when I'm telling somebody else's story, and they call me afterwards and said, "You got it just right." You know, and not everybody does. Some people, I don't hear from again, and I don't take that as a good thing. Don't take it necessarily as bad, but then other people will call, oh, you left out the such and such, and well, you never told me about that, or, you know, and I didn't ask that question. You're right. So when it works, it's exciting that somebody, you got it just right, because, you know, and you captured it. And then I hear from other people who will say to me, well, what can we do about this? Ah, I grab them.
Oh, and what a lovely, lovely experience.
Yeah, it is. And I would think that part of it would be similar when, oh, yeah, what can we do about it? Or I'm part of that, or I really understood. Or did you mean when you were saying such and such, because they really processed that poem?
Yes, I actually just recently heard from a stranger who found me on Facebook because she bought my book and loved it and wanted to tell me you know, how much Letters to Petrarch meant to her. And that is like sort of the best possible scenario for me as a poet, and I think especially growing up queer and being this person that was always very invested in words and in writing, like Edna St. Vincent Millay was a huge influence for me growing up, and she of course had like dalliances with all sorts of people, including women, in the 20s, and her poetry was really powerful for me. It made me feel less alone, and that is tremendous for a person who is growing up queer, right? That is life-saving for somebody growing up queer, to not feel isolated. So I think that's sort of the goal of it now, is to like pay that forward, to with my work create a space for people to feel not alone. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Do you know, it's one of the reasons we do this show, because we hear from people all the time who don't have access to, you know, on the internet they might, but they don't have real access to seeing real people and hearing people every week, and it helps them get through their coming out or their horrible experiences in high school. Yeah, same sort of thing. So yes, it makes sense, and we do it in different ways. You know, LeBron and I go on the radio and we're stupid, and you're doing it through your poetry.
Did you ever feel, because you know, we all have some writing experiences published in different ways, but sometimes for me I'm like, you know, I don't know if I want to get that personal. Do you ever feel like you need to hold back, like I need to retain something for me? That's a little too personal. Or some people just like, you know, no, I put it
she's
all
she's looking
out
there at me, and she's got her reasons.
Some people just put it all out there.
Well, you know something? I mean, honestly, just even as a strategy, I have discovered that if you start with something that's intensely painful, and it's the last thing you would want to talk to anyone about, that those poems almost write themselves.
Yeah.
So it's a great place to start, but yeah, you know, maybe it's because I love the theater, and maybe it's because I'm utterly shameless. Maybe it's because I've been in therapy all of my adult life, you know, but yeah, you know, I just find, you know, why not? Honestly, although in all fairness, I wrote a poem called Jockstrap that is not actually my anecdote. It's an anecdote gotcha. That I got from another guy. Someone actually walked out of that reading. And when I told my friend Liza about it, Liza Bachman Carruthers, she looked at me and she said, "Well, you kind of like that though, don't you?" And I thought, "Well, yeah, I do."
We need to take a break, but other than somebody walking out because they're bored.
No.
This is somebody walking out because they really had a reaction to something you wrote.
Oh, he was offended. His brow was furrowed, and during the time I was reading it, he was saying, no. And he was not a happy man.
We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. Our guests are Chris Soden and Logan Cure. And Christopher, from your book Closer, we're going to open the next segment of the show. We'll be back with more right after this.
This is Jennifer Maddox with Jonathan's Place, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laurent Landis. Chris Soden is looking through his book Closer to find a poem that he'd like to start with. Do you have one?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, just as a brief introduction, a lot of my poetry explores relationships I've had where I've had crushes on straight male friends. I fell in love with this guy when I was in the MFA program at Vermont College. His name is DJ, and he was just angry. He was angry all the time, and you could just feel it coming off of him. And, of course, I found that irresistible. And so the title of this poem is called Ghost Father. And he reminded me of my dad in a lot of ways. And so I dedicated it to DJ, which I doubt he'd even pick up a book of my poetry, but doesn't matter. Ghost Father. I was certain he was channeling my dead father, Jim. Though half my age, he was sharp and ragged, with black hair, formidable glasses, and skin like milk from a star cluster. He was one of those canny males, always stifling the impulse to snap you like brittle kindling, pugnacious, sharp, never looking beyond the literal. substance of a word or a glance or a hand fluttering and flittering for connection. I fell far and fast, ridiculous as a bottle rocket, igniting its entire payload for a glimpse of illumination, only to end up a husk in tall summer grass. I carried a sticky history he would neither identify nor honor for one cold season after another, misconstruing a token or portent or signal as if using a compass from another galaxy, or perhaps mine was the one with the floating, dizzy needle spinning beyond comprehension. The emails I sent never answered, yet each new residency, he seemed different. The anger that drew me less toxic and clarified. I remember waving to him across campus, gleaning a lapse in understanding, greeting mistaken for resignation, as if the loneliness I yearned to shatter only spread like a cultivated virus. The last semester we spoke on a terrace, snow scattering delicate, exquisite nets woven from icy breath and tears. He was there for my lecture and reading, first in line to embrace and tell me how proud he was, though I never told him, knowing he was listening, made it possible to break open like a deep purple zinnia, spilling my rage and regret. I never told him sex is easy to forfeit, like poison you can no longer trace. I cannot bear to look at the last and only snap we took together, or sop the grief endlessly pouring when I divulged to myself the unsecret secret that he was now and finally gone.
Oh, that was great. Uh-huh. Well, I should do recordings of these. like come out with a CD of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you can tell how this really came from the heart, because we're going to go to Logan right now to give Chris a second to recover. They have an event this week. It's Wednesday, September 21st, 8 p.m. at the Contemporary Theater of Dallas, which is at 5601 Sears Street. It is Pandora's Box presenting the Gertrude Stein and Allen Ginsberg LGBT Pride reading in honor of Pride Month that we have here in Dallas in September. Tell us a little bit. I was going to say, we talked a little bit about the Allen Ginsberg part. Tell us a little bit about Gertrude Stein.
Okay. Gertrude Stein was actually born in, 1874.
What's she doing now?
Well, couldn't tell you.
She's listening.
I hope so. I'd like to think that she is. Her writing was extremely experimental and amazing. She was influenced by the Cubists, and she wrote, her most famous collection of poetry is Tender Buttons. And they're all prose poems, and they use repetition a lot. They're surreal. They use non-linear logic. They're very intuitive. And she, as many of you probably know, she was actually born in America. She expatriated to Paris with her partner, Alice B. Toklas, where they held a salon that hosted many, many famous artists like Pablo Picasso and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway. They welcomed expatriated Americans into their salon. But her technique in prose and in poetry was a watershed in American letters. It had a profound impact. And speaking as someone who loves Tender Buttons and loves her poetry, you know, I know you either, I think, you read it and you immediately connect to it, or you despise it. I know lots of people who say, oh, God, not Gertrude Stein. But she's really a phenomenal poet and just wrote beautiful poetry that just eschewed, you know, conventional logic. But it was so intuitive and it was so amazing to read and partake of. And, you know, she had a profound, profound impact on American literature. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that was why I picked her and Ginsberg, is, you know, two queer poets who just took the world by storm and continue to do so.
And when we talked about this ahead of time, when we talked about your coming on the show, one of the things I loved about this was that Ginsberg and Stein both predate Stonewall. I don't know how many times you hear from people that, oh, well, the gay rights movement, you know, gay rights started in 1969 with Stonewall. There was never anything before that. There weren't gay people before that.
Right.
Well, of course there were. And these are some examples of them. Do you want to read something from You Have Tender Buttons?
Yeah. Well, Logan, would you like to read this one?
Sure. This is A Light in the Moon. A light in the moon, the only light is on Sunday. What was the sensible decision? The sensible decision was that notwithstanding many declarations and more music, not even notwithstanding the choice and a torch and a collection, notwithstanding the celebrating hat and a vacation and even more noise than cutting, notwithstanding Europe and Asia and being overbearing, not even notwithstanding an elephant and a strict occasion, not even withstanding more cultivation and some seasoning, not even with drowning and with the ocean being encircling, not even with more likeness and any cloud, not even with terrific sacrifice of pedestrianism and a special resolution, not even more likely to be pleasing. The care with which the rain is wrong, and the green is wrong, and the white is wrong. The care with which there is a chair and plenty of breathing. The care with which there is incredible justice and likeness. All this makes a magnificent asparagus, and also a fountain.
It makes us an asparagus and also a fountain. I love that ending.
Really trippy, you know?
Very odd.
it is.
Yeah, it's super weird. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that when we were talking about, you know, they were pre-Stonewall, completely pre-Stonewall. She was decades pre-Stonewall.
Incredibly unapologetic and out there. The fact that she was just a big old dyke.
Is that why she moved to Paris?
You know, that would be my guess.
Because they couldn't live that life here.
I can't imagine.
Ginsberg, when he lived here decades later, he was arrested for his book Howl.
Yeah. So there was a lot of legal harassment, but they were both extremely forthcoming about their orientation. And, you know, several members of the Beat, because, you know, Alan was a beat poet, were gay. You know, William S. Burroughs was, too.
Ferlin Getty, wasn't he?
I'm not sure. Ferlin Getty, I'm not sure. Maybe. But, yeah, you're right. They predated Stonewall. But I can completely understand why she would expatriate. Because, like you said, in America, the homophobia was, you know, even worse, mm-hmm. you know.
Worse than, yeah. And as we were talking about the trial that Allen Ginsberg endured for Howl, which was an obscenity trial. Yesterday at Teen Pride, there were four protesters with a bullhorn. Now, these are kids who were at this event, and they were shouting obscenities, and they were, you know, talking about all kinds of sexual whatever. It was just odd, these types of things that they're talking about. And nothing. The police were unable to take them off the bullhorn, even, shouting at kids. They were unable to stop that kind of obscenity on a public street. To read Howl, you have to buy the book. You have to go to a bookstore, especially then. You couldn't even get it on the internet. You had to go to a bookstore, find the book on the shelves, pick it up, pay for it, take it home, and then you could read it. And that was obscene. But somebody standing in the street screaming obscenities at kids is not obscene anymore. Isn't that interesting?
It is. It's a shame there's no reparative therapy for rabid homophobes.
This group has a history of anti-Muslim, anti-everything. We shouldn't take it too personally. They are just against anybody and everybody. But interesting how this lesbian couple had to move to Paris just so that they could write their poetry and hold their salons and be open about who they were. They couldn't do it here.
I think in some ways it was very brave of them. I mean, she had had a fair amount of exposure to other countries in Europe just growing up as a little girl, which probably helped. But, and as we were talking about before, you know, Patricia Highsmith, who is the wonderful detective novel writer who wrote,
from Fort Worth.
Yes, she moved. She moved to Paris, and it's just to me. I mean, just if you have to guess, but you know, I've certainly, and Logan, and we've all been exposed to that kind of, you know, abuse and contempt and ugliness. And if you're ready to expatriate and be in a place where you don't have to deal with that kind of ridiculousness, you know. And she, you know, they ran the most famous salon in Paris. Mm-hmm. And all the great artists went there.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the most famous English language salon. It really was one of the most famous salons ever in Paris.
And in history. Yeah.
Yeah. And can you tell us anything about Alice B. Toklas?
Oh, wow. I just know that Alice B. Toklas
Other than her pot brownies.
Yes, Alice. And you know, a lot of people don't even get that reference. Mm-hmm. Yes, Alice B. Toklas brownies are hash brownies. Alice B. Toklas was her partner, and she wrote a famous cookbook called Murder in the Kitchen. But, you know, other than that they were devoted to each other and that they, you know, lived together, I mean, She was Alice B. Toklas. They were each other's wives. Mm-hmm. You've caught me out. But they loved each other dearly.
And we are running out of time. Just give us the information about the Pride reading.
So it's this Wednesday, 8:00 at the Contemporary Theater of Dallas,
which is near Greenville and Ross Avenue. It's like a block off.
Fantastic space. Yeah. The acoustics are great, which I really appreciate. And there's a bar inside there, so, you know.
Which Laurent really appreciates.
Yeah.
Always appreciate that.
Yeah, so you don't have to be thirsty while you listen to the poetry.
And it might make some of the poetry sound better.
Always.
I always drink after a good poetry reading. It's medicinal.
Everybody, is there a cost?
Oh, no. Now, we welcome donations, mm-hmm. and we encourage donations, absolutely. And, you know your kids, but we do encourage parental discretion because these are going to be frank and amazing and just bone-rattling poetry. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Just bear that in mind.
Great. Appreciate that caveat. Want me to bring in my 7-year-old? Thank you all very much.
Yeah, come back and see us again.
Thank you so much for having us.
Especially when your book comes out. Can't wait to read that.
We'd love to.
Thank you.
And next week, our guest is Rebecca Covell.
Oh, awesome.